Media Production.
Hey everybody, hope you're doing well. Today we have a special episode, special for a couple of reasons. A, the conversation is just really, really cool. We had some rad people in studio. And B, because this was a collaboration with the Boardman Review. So if you're familiar at all with the Boardman Review, they started a podcast collective. I want to say, man, maybe like last fall. And it's a collection of shows where they're featuring creatives from this area. And for their show, they like to highlight people from their past issues that they've had in their quarterly journals. And this one was a little bit different for them as well, because Troubled Water Film, who we interviewed in this conversation, was not part of a past issue, but they just had a really cool story and they were doing some really cool advocacy on behalf of the Great Lakes and really any and all of the waterways in Michigan. So we brought them in studio and we did like this dual interview with Chris and William from the Troubled Water Film. And we got them just about a third of the way or almost half of the way through their journey, where they were paddling from Mackinac Island all the way down to Lansing. And this was just to raise awareness for the Great Lakes, for the river systems, about things like water quality, oil pipelines, invasive species. It was just really cool to sit down and talk with them, and really left me wondering and thinking, are there things that I care about deeply enough that I could commit 30 to 45 days of just grueling physical labor as they were paddling? And do I care? Am I passionate enough? Do I put my money where my mouth is? Do I put the effort forth when I say that I actually care about something? And these guys are, they're not just show, there's go involved. And it was just really awesome and an honor to have them in studio. And so I think you guys will enjoy this conversation as we tag teamed the interview with Nick and Chris from the Boardman Review. Here we go.
We have the fellas from Troubled Waters, and they are in the middle, maybe not even quite the middle of epic journey. And there's some pretty awesome advocacy efforts that are taking place through this physical trial that they put on themselves. So why don't we just start with you guys introducing yourselves? And then also we have Chris and Nick from the Boardman Review that are also in the house. So we're just going to have a cool conversation discussing why this event is taking place, what the passions are behind it, and what it's entailed so far. So whoever wants to start can go ahead.
Perfect. We'll have Chris start first here, but we're happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm Chris Yahanda. I'm, as was said, one of the guys paddling for the Troubled Water movie or Troubled Water documentary, which is a 425-mile journey from Mackinac Island to Lansing on stand-up paddleboards. And what we're, you know, the goal of it is not only just to explore and have a nice little adventure, but also to bring up advocacy for general conservation of the Great Lakes and hitting on topics such as the Line 5 oil pipeline in the Straits of Mackinac, invasive species and its negative effect on the fishing industries. And then as we get farther downstate, water quality issues with runoff from agricultures and cities and things like that. And so our goal is to just use our paddle journey as kind of a vehicle of delivering the beauty of the waters and the lands around here, and then use that as a narrative backbone to try to deliver the messages of these troubled waters, as we like to call them.
Yeah, well said. And I am his partner in the trip, William Wright. We're all from mostly Fort Wayne, Indiana. And our director, who's not here with us, Davis Huber, was also someone who grew up with us. So that's our crew. And we're already getting pretty tired. So we're about 142 miles into the journey. Just at Point Betsy, to where we decided to come here to Traverse City to talk to y'all. So we're excited.
It's really cool just to think that you guys aren't even born or grew up in Michigan necessarily, but it's still something that you are really valuing. I just find that to be interesting, because I think growing up in this state and now living in Traverse City, I've been in this area for going on 3 years, I think, and just seeing the value that people place on these resources when they're right next to you. Mm-hmm. But then the danger is if you're not existing next to it all the time, I think you kind of just end up taking it for granted. So I just, the genesis of that is really interesting, that you didn't grow up like in Traverse City or near the water necessarily, or maybe you did down there. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, so I was born in Ann Arbor, but then most of my life was spent growing up in Fort Wayne. Okay. But my family's ties to up here go back pretty far. On my mom's side of the family, my family's been coming up here since the 1940s. My great grandpa built a fishing cabin on Lake Skeekmaw. And then so every summer of my mom's life, every summer of my life has been spent like day school got out to the day you have to go back to school or for sports or whatever was up here. And then a few weeks in the winter and long weekends and things like that. So coming up here is a big part of like me and my family's identity and kind of has really formed the people we are. So while we're not, you know, full time around up here, it's like, it's the connection's pretty deep.
Yeah. I didn't mean to say that, you know, this is Michigan versus Indiana.
I'm not from around these parts.
And William, you have a tie to up here as well.
Absolutely. Right? I've been coming up just like Chris. We've been friends for ages back in Fort Wayne, but really kind of also spent the summers together just being about 30 minutes away from each other. I'm in the Petoskey area for most of my life coming up here. So it's been, you know, Indiana, Michigan, go to Wisconsin. It's all the Great Lakes states. So we're very close and we care deeply about the waters around here.
So how did you guys come up with this idea? Because what I've been kind of mulling over is that this is a huge endeavor. You talked about the sheer miles that you're covering. And for anybody that's paddleboarded for any period of time, it's incredibly tiring. Like I just tested out my parents. They got a paddleboard for their little pond and I never paddleboard and my toes were tired just from gripping the board.
Yeah, that's low key something. Yeah. Our toes get numb every day just from standing so much.
I have to wear booties because like the keeps the water warm around your toes. And it's standing on there for 8 hours. I can't do it barefoot. It's be terrible.
Yeah, that's crazy. And I just kept thinking like, is the difficulty of the endeavor in direct relation to how much you value the lakes and the waters and the rivers? Like, is that why you chose something so difficult because it's such a priority to you?
Or were you just not thinking ahead?
Yeah, right. I mean, there's definitely, I think the main aspect was we needed something to like garner attention, right? Like if we did a 30 mile paddle, people would be like, I don't care about that. Like, we're not going to listen to what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. So that was one fold. And then another aspect was, I think we just wanted to push ourselves. Like we've been, you know, paddling for years and years. Last year we went on like a 70 mile camping trip just for like a week via paddleboard. And it was kind of just a thing like, can we do it? We just wanted to like go on a full adventure, see if it was possible. Really just see what our limits were and push ourselves. It was kind of like twofold, but
yeah, Chris hit the genesis of it.
Yeah, one of them was definitely just
that paddleboard trip we did last year. It was only 70 miles. We just did it for fun. Our director Davis was there. Just like I said, we've been friends for ages, and he brought his camera and we just kind of saw last year's, as you know, everybody knows, the water levels were so high. So we were seeing paths falling into the water, trees and all this erosion. And then along the journey, we also got some notifications from the Oil and Water Don't Mix people about an injunction that a judge did to shut down temporarily one of the pipelines that crosses Line 5 or the Mackinac Straits. And then we were like, okay, well, what can we do? What can we do to make a difference? Chris and I, we don't have really too much to add to this advocacy groups, but we do love to paddle and Davis loves to tell a good story. So, we thought, you know, maybe we could do something extreme, like he said, something to bring attention and then, you know, share both the beauty and the struggles of the Great Lakes.
And I think some of the, like where you're starting and where you're ending obviously have a big significance to why you're doing it.
Absolutely.
Starting in the Straits near where Line 5 is and then ending in Lansing. Talk about how that journey kind of came about in terms of like mapping it out and everything.
And you actually hit something very important there. So we chose the Straits and we actually chose Mackinac Island because of the governor's mansion on it. So we wanted it to be kind of governor centric because when we were ideating this journey a year ago, there was no revoking of the easement that the governor did, you know, this past few months. And so, you know, we decided, okay, maybe we can start at the governor's mansion and end at the governor's office to try to, you know, implore her to do this. But then, you know, once the revoking of the easement happened, we kind of said, okay, well, maybe it's more of a in support of the governor and her plight. And then we also opened up our scope for our project a little bit larger and started looking into invasive species and other issues that are kind of plaguing the lakes. So that's kind of like the idea of the start and the finish, but you're right. I mean, it's a long way and it's a little bit ambitious.
So what are some of the other kind of like organizations that you've linked up with through the process? I know that you've been working with a lot of like people that we know that are from this area, but talk a bit about that.
Yeah.
So the ones that we started with were Oil and Water Don't Mix. Bill Laca there, who's one of the founders, was kind of one of the first people we started talking to. As William said, Line 5 was kind of our original emphasis. And so he's like the head authority up here when it comes to the fight to shut down Line 5. And then we also, through him, got introduced to Liz Kirkwood and the team over at Flow, and they were super helpful. So throughout really the fall through the winter, we kind of had like biweekly meetings with Liz and team, just trying to educate ourselves on all the different issues and trying to really get our head around everything that's going on with this whole advocacy movement. And then once the trip started to become a more real thing, and we got into fundraising and, you know, media and all this other stuff, we've been pretty lucky to have some cool sponsors. So M22 has been really, really helpful with us. We just actually this week released a joint shirt with them and Flow that, you know, has our logos on the back, and some of the proceeds get split between us and Flow. And then Mobby Wine, also out in Suns Bay, they released a bottle for us. It's called like a Shutdown Line 5 bottle that they'll be selling throughout the entire summer. And actually right after this, we're heading up there for an event. So they've been super helpful. And then just a lot of private donors, people in the area that are really passionate about it. We've been working with Leland All Conservancy, getting contacted through people like that. So overall, it's just been kind of a community gathering and help. And it's been really awesome to see everybody be so supportive.
That's great to have all that support. That those are some key hitters for sure. You know, we know Liz and pretty well from Flow, and we've worked with Flow before on a few things. So so you have the support, and maybe I'm jumping the gun, but I'm kind of excited to ask about your trip a little more in detail. Anything pop out, anything surprising along the way? Or, you know, we talked a bit about the weather changes already, but anything that's noteworthy?
Oh, just the wind. Oh, the wind sucks. Yeah.
Was it the straits? Like, obviously the wind we know is crazy up there, but.
So we lucked. Well, so yeah, there's a little bit of a story at the straits, but overall we were lucky that we started at the straits, right? Cause we could choose the perfect day to go. And we were up in Petoskey, just packing and preparing and just constantly monitoring the weather and the winds. And whenever it like popped up, like, all right, it was like June 9th. It was like, June 9th looks like a good day to go. Like, that's what we're aiming for. And it ended up being perfect, but you know, we were so concentrated on winds and things like that, that we didn't even think about fog being a factor. And so we woke up at 4:45 morning of the 9th, ready to paddle. And we got down to the harbor at Mackinac, and you literally could not see like beyond 100 feet because there was so much fog. And so we were sitting there like debating, should we go? Should we not? Like, we have this support boat with the film crew in it, and we downloaded like this app to check for freighters and everything. We're like thinking about going, and then not more than 5 minutes after we had that conversation, like right outside the harbor, we just hear this massive like fog horn, and out of the mist just comes this like 700 foot freighter that didn't see. And we were just like, all right, yep, no, we're not going. We're waiting.
What a great sign for that trip. That's so great.
It was like this ghost freighter out of like,
yeah, it looked like it should be like White some Walkers movie on it or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know of the apps and the stuff that you can see. Not all of them are on there too. And that's what I was thinking of, especially in that stretch. Wow. That would be a straight quick no for me.
Yeah.
But that's so funny that you had that experience. Pretty cool.
This is crazy because so I spent some time living in Sheboygan, which is right on the Straits of Mackinac. And my wife and I she had gotten her first job out of college, and we found this rental. The market in Sheboygan is much different than it is in Traverse City. We afforded this rental that we would never be able to like own ourselves. And it was right on the Straits of Mackinac. And you're right, dude, the fog is so crazy. There'd be times where we have, you know, the windows in our bedroom open, and you know that, or you don't even know that there's anything out there. And then all of a sudden you hear the foghorn. It's like, that's just wild. But it kind of gives me a little bit of perspective of, you know, that's a great memory that I have, having lived for a year right on the Straits and being able to just go down there and swim and look across and see the lights of Mackinac Island and all these great things that Michigan has, the bridge and everything. But that it's a really fine line between being something that you can enjoy, but that it's something that could very easily go away if something goes wrong with that pipeline.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's what we realized. So like once the fog lifted and we can see our target, which was, you know, the uprights of the Mackinac Bridge, And we started paddling down there, and just like the scope of this man-made structure that is huge. When you're sitting down there on a paddleboard and you're looking up and you're hearing the traffic go across and or above you, it's like you can't help but just be in awe by the engineering feat that was Mackinac Bridge.
Yeah.
But then there's also this other, you know, engineering feat at the time was the pipelines that they put underneath. And so this line five that, you know, starts up near Duluth and works its way to the bottom of the UP and crosses the straits where it splits into two twin pipelines. We couldn't help but think, like, if something were to rupture here, we've talked to enough people at this point that this is one of the worst places, especially for fresh water, to ever have an oil spill. So, you know, yes, man is able to conquer these great, crazy places, but, you know, at some point, at what risk? You know, the pipeline's already 68 years old, which means, and at the point of which it was built for 50. That's good. That's a good job to the engineers who built it. Good job to the people who maintained it. But now it's a little precarious. So if something were to happen, the water sloshes between Lake Huron and Lake Michigan, and that could go everywhere.
Yeah, I was thinking about the beginning of your trip there, how Mackinac Island is a sort of like isolated, you know, Pleasantville kind of setting. Mm-hmm, and it's kind of representative of what you're saying, where, you know, there's this beauty of the lakes and everything, and then you take off, and then now you're suddenly, you know, you're encountering the dangers of the waters, and just that whole representation is pretty spot on too, I feel like, because you're getting out of a comfort zone and then heading out into the water. And I don't know, I just love that you started in Mackinac Island. It's such a great spot.
Well, and also potentially how a place as idyllic as Mackinac Island could, you know, potentially get, you know, really disrupted by any kind of, you know, rupture in line five or something like that. And I mean, the idea that it is between two lakes is kind of, you know, people can visualize that a little bit easier, but that is a fact of the situation. And, yeah. So what, after, you know, you got past the bridge, what was kind of your next target or kind of your next, you know, highlight that you saw?
Yes. So that's where, yeah, the outside of the fog, the crossing of the straits went pretty smoothly, but then the little sketchy part, very surprisingly came after we got under the bridge and kind of made it across. So McGulpin's Point, which is like right past the bridge heading west, we like landed there, took a little break. We're like, crossing's done, we're good. And there's a bay just down that's probably 4 miles across and like 2 miles deep. And by the time we got there, the winds had started picking up and the winds were like directly parallel to shore. And so we started just downwinding. We were cruising. We were like making time and
we were feeling good. Yeah, there's hubris. We're like, we conquered the straits. Feeling good.
Let's do 800 miles.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we'll be lancing tomorrow. And so we got out like a mile into that bay and the winds either bent or changed or something, but they went from being like totally sideshore pushing us to going totally offshore out of the bay. So we were like 2 miles out in the water, like from the shore, and then probably another 3 to the shore in front of us, just getting blown offshore, just out into nothing. And so we were just like, this is not good. Like, we're not calling the Coast Guard on our first day. And so we had to sit down on our boards and just like paddle as hard as we could with one side. Because when you stand up, you're like a sail and the wind just pushes you. So we were sitting down, just paddling one side just to go straight. And it was probably like an hour and a half of just torture of just paddling one side just to make it to the shore on the other side.
If you can't tell, our right arms are huge.
yeah. That's crazy. Yeah.
And so, it's also humbling. Like, as a stand-up paddleboarder, the first day you sit down to try to avoid the wind.
You're so exposed in that, you know, on stand-up. It's so, that's crazy. Crossing the mouth of a bay.
Well, what is that line between, I'm sure it's really fine, but between, this is just a headache, it's an inconvenience, it's kind of blowing us off course, to, this is actually dangerous. How many times have you crossed that line in just the first little bit of this trip?
So I think that's a good question, actually, I don't know exactly when that line hits. There was a clear moment in my head where I was just like, all right, this is like focus time. Like, you can't, this is just like, you have to make it to the other side. But like a number of wind, I don't think we have. I think it's just more like it's really dependent where you are and like how far you are from shore and things like that. But that definitely kind of wises us up a little bit. Whenever we come across big bays like that and the winds are up a little bit, we're definitely taking a little less aggressive lines after that one. Mm-hmm. I guess it was a good first lesson on the first day.
So did you dip into the bays? Like to,
that's what we do now.
Yeah.
Unless it's dead call. And then we can
shoot it adds length to your trip.
Though. It does.
So, yeah,
it
adds, that's a tough call. I'm sure.
Exactly. So that's what I'm saying. We were feeling really cocky. We were just finished the straights and we like took the exact like hypotenuse type of the bay. And you're right. There's a point where you can feel, you first feel the change in the way the waves are. When you're downwinding, they're organized, they're at your back. You can like paddle really fast and catch them and you know, you're flying. And then all of a sudden you just get like this disorganization where there's some waves coming and they're peaking at different angles. And then you are realizing, oh, I'm going offshore. And to me, I mean, it was very scary because we've been told about these straits and you're looking off and the only thing that you might be able to see offshore is maybe this tiny little lighthouse that's far out there. And so we're like, okay, well, I mean, I was probably more scared than Chris, but I like immediately sat down and was paddling for it felt like an hour and a half of just to get diagonally to the shore. So I don't know what that line is, what you're saying, but we've probably really only experienced it that one time at the straits.
And, so far,
and yeah. I think we probably would have experienced it at a different time if we didn't experience it then, because we did learn to a little bit more.
And I'm guessing there was a little bit of training, you know, that, or just preparation for something like this. You can maybe talk about a little bit of your like experience paddleboarding, but also then, you know, do you have help on your trip and what does that look like?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess like paddleboarding generally, or like the months leading up to this?
I mean, a little bit of both. I would assume that you've been paddleboarders for, you know, a number of years now. And then, and then has there been a certain thing where you're like, I'm either going to get ripped right now or do I get ripped beforehand?
Yeah. So paddleboarding, I mean, I've always loved paddleboarding. It's been like a part of my daily routine up here since I was a kid. And then, dabbled in like competitive races and stuff up here for a little bit. And then I guess preparing for this trip, I came up in mid-May, so I got a little less than a month of, and I was just kind of like in training camp mode, just trying to paddle as much as possible. And then before that, I was living out west in the winter, so I was doing a lot of skiing and did a lot of like skinning to stay in shape, like skinning up mountains and things like that. So it was just more of a trying to be outside and active, I guess, as much as possible. And then in those weeks leading up, trying to paddle as much as possible, but there wasn't, like, we didn't have like a strict like regimen of like what we need to do, is just trying to stay as active and outside as possible.
You weren't waking him, you know, waking William up at like 6
a.m. No, he was out in like, L.A. He was in Cabo the week before he did this. So that was his dream.
Like, I gained weight.
Yeah, exactly. The first time I touched the paddle boards was only a few days before the journey.
No way.
We used to paddle all the time the previous summers, and like, I'm not worried about the technique or getting out there, but I was a little bit worried about just the exhaustion after the first few days. Cause Chris in general is just a stronger paddler. He's like, he said, he did races where I would just do like occasional fun trips and, you know, use it to get around from place to place on a inland lake or something like that. But I think I had a little bit more of the shock of what we were doing once we started.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So far, like, I think we talked about this maybe in a previous conversation, but do you have any kind of support vehicle that, or, you know, boat, that
so
kind of thing?
So in this room right now, we have a PA over here, a good friend, Landon. And then our director, Davis, like I mentioned, they're actually on a support boat when they're getting film. So at any of the open water stretches, we have them join us for sure. Cause there's a lot of logistics with getting the boats in at, you know, different harbors or whatever it might be. But they're there for when we're crossing 8 to 10 miles with nothing close to us. But other than that, they'll just jump in when there's to get sick footage of Sleeping Bear Dunes or, go to the Manitous or something like that. And then otherwise it's just kind of Chris and I carrying all of our gear. Like, you guys should see our paddle boards. They're really cool.
You have them outside, don't you?
We have them outside on top of the car right now.
Go check them out.
Yeah. But like when they're fully fitted, it's like a spectacle. I really enjoy looking at them.
Got a solar panel. Yeah,
solar panel battery. Hooking up to the battery on top of our camping gear. Got bags in the front and the back. Sweet. He's got a camera because we have to have like interviews that, you know, journal interviews that we do nightly and all that kind of stuff for the documentary. So we're Chris and I are pretty self-sufficient on the boards, but we always like having the sport crew there.
I would think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd seen the photo of like the solar panels and stuff on the boards. And that's just really interesting. Are you missing anything like on your board that you were like, oh, I really should have thought of this, but I just didn't know until you're in the middle of a 400-mile trip?
That was the nice thing about having that kind of an accidental test run last summer, that trip that we did, is we just kind of got to like work out the kinks and like know what you need when you're on your board. Like last year we didn't really do any org. You had those big dry sacks on your board and I kind of just threw all my stuff in there. I was like, got to find it when I got to find it. But this year, like the organization is so much better. We have, you know, stuff sacks within each dry bag, like labeled and everything like that. Knowing like what to keep on top, you want to get easy access to your food while you're paddling, things like that. So last year really helped in that aspect. So I don't really think, at least so far, I mean, fingers crossed, knock on wood, whatever, but I, so far, nothing has been like, I'm really missing this so far. I had last couple days, I had a can of bug spray explode in my dry bag. So everything was just covered in bug spray. But other than that, that was really the only thing that I'm
covered, and we're in the same tent, so it pretty much was on my stuff too.
Yeah. It's nice, man. Keeps the bugs away.
Yeah. Yeah. You'll be all set for that.
Yeah, exactly.
So
have it around you.
So you've been tested a few times for sure. How about things that are just like, that's amazing seeing that in a situation that you never would have, you know, had unless you were on this trip.
So this might be preaching to the choir, but the Leelanau Peninsula is one of the most beautiful places I have ever paddled next to. Cause the other, like, Wilderness State Park was beautiful, and going down to Little Traverse is great. Fisherman Island is cool, but nothing has the verticality so far that Leland has. And so just seeing, it doesn't have to be Sleeping Bear. It doesn't have to be Pyramid Point. There's like beautiful bluffs and dunes across that whole entire area that feed into deep, fresh, clear water, where you can see schools of fish, balls of bait fish. Like, it's just, it was extremely beautiful. We had beautiful weather crossing it. So I think that's like one of the places or things that I've seen along the way that's been unbelievable.
For me, it was going out to the manatees. I've always seen them out from distance, but I'd never been out. And then specifically, I'd always like really wanted to go to the Francisco Morazan wreck.
Shipwreck.
And so we were able to do that a few days ago. And then Davis, our director, rented some scuba gear and was able to dive and get some really cool footage. And it was just like a beautiful sunset when we were out there. So that was definitely one to check off the list that I've always wanted to do.
Smells terrible
there. Yeah, it smells horrible.
Yeah, there's a lot of birds around.
Oh my God. Yeah. Didn't know that was a nesting site. I mean, that's crazy.
I mean, it's insane how many birds up on the bluffs too. Like, I think they're cormorants, right? Yeah. They're just every, it looks like Jurassic Park.
Yeah. And you camped out there, I'm guessing.
We camped out there. We talked to the guides, national parks people there, and they hooked us up with a spot, which was nice. But paddling anywhere near that Francisco Morazan, you just get these seagulls dive bombing you. I think there's like, it's nesting, so they're like a little bit protective. And I feel like they use,
it's like a poop factory.
Yeah, they use it to like bird shot the opposite direction at you.
Yeah, we were dodging it left and right.
Like, it's a sight with it sticking out the water like that, no matter what, without the birds. I still remember seeing it for the first time. We took a boat trip across, and we always thought, joke, because Nick fell asleep and missed it.
I don't remember it. But just like, but I was also like six or something. Okay.
The first time seeing it, you just don't expect it to be so big outside the water. Never mind what's underneath the water. It's a really interesting sight for sure. Yeah. So that's cool. I guess I didn't realize that you went out there and camped out there on the island. Yeah. That's really,
we didn't paddle though. We will say we didn't paddle up there. We knew that's kind of out of our way. So we took our support boat and went up there.
That makes sense. Absolutely. Yeah. So how about approaching like, well, your most recent stop was Point Betsy, right? So how about that approach? That must've been pretty interesting. Like that coming down.
Yeah, that was super cool. We had really good calm weather for that whole section. So we did Glen Arbor to Point Betsy in one day, which was like 24 miles. So that whole stretch is absolutely beautiful. And it's pretty awesome how well conserved and pretty untouched it is. There's like so much, you know, state park or national shoreline or whatever it is. But, William made the point while we were paddling that it probably looked pretty similar to what it does now, like 500 years ago, just because it's so well preserved and untouched. That was a really beautiful portion. And then, as soon as we got to Point Betsy, the fan turned on. And as we were saying before, it was like 40 mile an hour winds and 4-foot waves. So there's no paddling to be done there. So that's as far as we've gotten.
Yeah, we had some stuff in our tent, like, put up above us to organize, and we wake up at like 7:30 with this stuff just hitting us in the face because our tent's being blown around. Like, right. It was some intense wind.
Where did you camp?
Just on the shoreline beyond the dunes, down from the lighthouse.
Yeah, cool.
We don't always have campsites.
They're not the most understood. Official campsites sometimes.
Understood. That's cool.
You're like, it was someone's beach.
Yeah, exactly. I got permission. Yeah.
Yeah. From here on out, we have permission wherever we're at. Okay.
Go ahead, Nick.
Oh, yeah. It was the point that you made about how it potentially looked probably similar that in Den, you know, hundreds of years ago, I think is a really important point because a lot of that land is now national lakeshore. Mm-hmm. And then like when you're talking about those kind of that vertical, that those dunes up, you know, by Leland, north of Leland, that's a lot of that is like clay cliffs and Whaleback, which are protected lands by Leland Aw Conservancy, mm-hmm. which is, you know, one of your partners. So I think, you know, that kind of gives a really good visual of how that can affect, you know, your viewpoint from the water, not just from, you know, M22 or something like that. Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure that was, you know, a big reason for, you know, your trip and whatnot and having those partners.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead. I was gonna say, what's next? Now you're stopped here, you know, you're talking with us. So what's the very next thing?
Chris will tell us what's next. I kind of let him take most of the journey stuff.
Yeah. Who's logistics? Who's like,
I'm logistics, know, outside of the journey. He's logistics.
The big like media fundraising guy. Then I've kind of been the more of the trip guy.
Plan the trip.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. So I've been glued on Windfinder. We're not even sponsored or anything by them, but glued on Windfinder.
But we're looking for sponsors. Yeah,
Windfinder, Windfinder, if you're listening. Yeah.
You should be sponsored by the wind.
Yeah, right. Yeah, own the means of production. the next few days do not look good for us. It's like super strong from the south and we're heading south, so that's not great. I think it's kind of the cadence we've fallen into in the last week or so. And I think it's just going to be more so of that as we head down and we're on the bigger water, is that the days when it's calm or the wind is in our favor are just going to have to be really, really big days, like 20 plus miles. And then when it's coming up from the south or against us, or, you know, particularly choppy or something, we're just going to have to wait it out and maybe look for a couple windows here and there where we can squeeze in a few miles in a few hours or whatever it is. So the next immediate future doesn't look great. We'll probably maybe just keep an eye on it. And if there's an early morning where we can get out and try to get a few miles, then we'll try to do that. But from the far out projections, I guess this weekend, it's looking like it might be a little calmer coming from the north. So hopefully we can start making more headway again. But
towards just, what? Frankfurt?
Towards Frankfurt, Manistee, down to Ludington. We're trying to make it like 70-ish miles a week. So that would put us down by Ludington, hopefully by week from now, but you know, so much is out of our control.
And then you go inland then?
We make it down to Grand Haven. So the whole big lake section is like 270 miles. So we're a little over half done with the big lake so far. And then once we get down to Grand Haven, we'll hop in the Grand River, and that's like
140
miles. And then there's some portages we have to do. So
sure.
But yeah, and then it's like 140 miles up to Lansing through there.
And that'll probably be a lot more consistent in terms of conditions.
Yeah, so we're dreading the river because it's just going to be like a water treadmill, just like the same thing. And it's like
we're going upstream.
Yeah, wow. That's going to be. Do you know what intense. The current's like?
No, told is pretty calm. Like okay. 3 miles an hour is what to expect. I mean, I'm hoping I'm wrong. I'm going with super low expectations just to be pleased. But I'm just visioning like buggy, muddy, treadmill for a week. Mm-hmm. But we're hoping like we don't have to worry about the wind when we're there. We relatively know what the conditions are going to be every day, so we're just hoping we can just, you know, get that done relatively quickly. We're hoping like 8 to 10 days.
Yeah. Nice.
Okay. Mostly concerned about campsites,
right? Yeah, getting to them. And right. Yeah. Yeah, that'll be fascinating though. They're doing that much inland on a stretch of that sounds really interesting, because you're going to be right up against, you know, you're going to go from fields of nothing to inner city areas and all kinds of stuff. So yeah, it should be
absolutely pass right by Grand Rapids. We'll be talking to the people there about their restoration of the Grand Rapids. So they're doing a lot to their river section. not only to do with some of the topics we're talking about, invasive species, which will be affected, but also just like the restoration of kind of the man-made impacts and restoring the rapids, which the city got its name. So,
right.
It's pretty cool.
Very
cool.
Could you frame for the average person, meaning me, what what speed is like on a paddleboard? So if we're talking just like glassy surfaces, how many miles could you cover in a specific amount of time, just as a reference point?
Yeah. So for us, we've been using on like total glass, we've been using like 4 miles an hour as our goalpost. Wow. And then when it's with us, if we're like downwinding, it's like 5. If it's, we're really cooking, 6. And then when it's against us, we're
0.
Like, yeah, I mean, really against us, negative. But just a little bit in our face, like 2.5-3 miles an hour. So those, obviously it varies with how tired we are and all that stuff, but those are kind of like the ballpark areas.
So if the river's 3 miles per hour,
how's
that work?
An SAT question. The river's going 3 miles per hour. You're seriously going 4. Yeah. How far backwards do you go?
Is it that equal?
I don't think it equals out.
It can't be like 1 mile an hour then.
Yeah. I don't think it is. I think our boards are actually just like extremely sleek and hydrodynamic.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's as bad as a 1 mile per hour net.
Yeah.
But we'll tell you when we get there.
Right. That's cool. Yeah. Without the wind too. Yeah.
What about you guys? So I think it's one thing. Since this is a huge endeavor, you have to kind of like the person that you're doing it with, right? You said you're sharing a tent and everything as well. So how has that been? How did you decide to say, I can pick this person to go on this journey with me because they're physically capable. I'm sure that's a big part of it, but also because they're not going to just make me want to jump into the water and swim backwards or something.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like if there's anyone that we've been not this intense or big, but we've been, you know, hanging out doing stuff like this since we were in kindergarten. So it was pretty obvious choice. If we were going to have to choose someone to do it, it was like, I think, you know, the first person on both of our minds would probably be each other.
Mm-hmm. It's a long interview period about 20 to 25 years process of selecting a person.
Nice.
Yeah. That's so great. I mean, we've also just been doing sports with each other for ages. We've been on same teams. I mean, Davis and I have dated the same girls. Like we've been around each other for a very long time and not at the same time. I'll say that.
Could be a whole nother podcast.
So it's pretty easy to pick this crew. Yeah.
Nice. Were there any tense moments like between you two? Like, you
I mean, there's like, every day or? I'm like, Chris, stop pushing the pace. Like, get closer to me. Like that type of thing.
Okay. That bug spray really.
Exactly. Yeah. It didn't actually go off. I pushed it in and sprayed it all over his back.
Take us through a perfect day where the weather's not going to get in the way of starts and stops. So you could go for as long as you'd like in a given day. What is that routine? So in terms of wake up and then paddling and meals and like all that stuff, just give us an overview.
We never wake up when we say we're going to wake up. That's the thing that we've kind of noticed is that through, you know, 140 whatever miles we're in, it's not like all of a sudden you wake up one day and you're like, oh, my shoulder's killing me, I can't paddle or anything like that. It's kind of just like it's a very slow grind. So it's like someone like poked a pinhole in your gas tank or something. Mm-hmm. Like you go to bed a little more tired every day, you wake up a little more tired every day. And so like every day we're like, all right, we're on the water by 8 and then we're on the water by 9:30 and just things like that. But I say, you know, when we wake up, pack up camp, you know, get all your stuff together. We don't, food wise, it's usually just like bars and jerky until dinner when we have a camping meal. And then if it's good weather, we try to stay on the boards as much as possible. So we'll just, you know, take water breaks and little food breaks and just sit on the boards. Just kind of keep paddling. And then once we have like an idea of where we're trying to get, and then once we get to that range, we'll just be, you know, looking for our pre-approved campgrounds.
Right. And this whole time we're not just doing our journey, right? So I think to factor into the average day is lots of times we might be meeting up with a interviewee at a certain location. So we might, you know, paddle 3 to 4 hours and then try to hook up with somebody as we pass Charlevoix, for example, or something like that. And then we'll probably set up camp or wherever it might be and try to get to bed. But also it's the 21st of June, which means the light up here is incredible. It means we have natural light up until like 10:30. So like Chris says, like, it's hard to wake up at 6 a.m. if you want to, when you're finally, you know, cooking and going to bed by like 12 or 1, yeah, depending on like where you are. Cause it's hard to go to sleep when it's light out and camping.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So go into more about the, cause the journey obviously is part of it, but you're creating a documentary out of this as well. And you're interviewing people along the way. So kind of go into that process, maybe who you're interviewing and what it's been like to be filming on your end. And then also having Davis, the director, you know, film as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Chris and I might be tired, and we definitely are, but so is our film crew. So is Landon and Davis. They're kind of running around trying to figure out the logistics for everything. But we've been, you know, started up in Mackinac Island, and that, you know, is a perfect place to introduce Line 5. So we have reached out to Enbridge and some other of those representatives from the company. We're still kind of working to see if they will, have a interview with us, but we've also talked to some of the native community, cause they're such a big representation of the reasons to keep this place, you know, pristine. And they've been fighting this battle for a long time as well. And so for that issue, that means we're talking to Enbridge, we're talking to the tribal community, we're talking to activists, which we said was Liz and Bill from Flow and Oil and Water, Sean McBrearty from Clean Water Action, our fiscal sponsors, Michigan Environmental Council. And then also we want to make sure, like, this documentary should not be some one-sided preach. We want to make sure we're getting both sides of the issue, because this is nuanced. I mean, like I said in the beginning, it was a marvel to put in this pipeline. Sure, maybe it wasn't the best place to do it, but, you know, there hasn't been a spill here. And so they've been maintaining it, maybe not as well as they should have, but, you know, there's still a human issue here. There's this people's livelihoods that depend on this. There's energy requirements that Michigan needs. There's propane in the UP that is required. So we're also talking to some senators up in the UP. We're talking to parliamentary representatives in Sarnia, where the oil is refined. So we're just trying to get a broad scope and play this out as, you know, as cleanly as we can, and let the viewer decide on where they're lie on this issue. But then that's just the Line 5 issue. We also have invasive species. So we'll be talking to the DNR, and again, the, you know, different fishermen, whether that's commercial tribal, whether that's commercial non, you know, tribal. And then some people that are working on maintaining or, you know, working on fish populations. So there's just like a lot of people to touch on, and it's actually very hard to do this while on the trip, to try to logistically plan out when you're going to be at a certain place to let them know. So a lot of these interviews have, you know, some of them happen, some of them will happen on the trip, some of them will happen after the trip. And then we'll do some clean water stuff as well, clean water quality issues, but that's more towards Makatawa, Lake Makatawa, where that's kind of a polluted place down a little bit south. I hear they call it Makatoilet. And so we'll be talking a lot of about that, but those interviews are being scheduled, haven't been scheduled yet, and we'll just have to tackle it as we move down.
Right. Yeah, it's probably hard to, you know, be able to schedule something when you can't even keep moving because wind all of a sudden pops up or something.
Exactly.
Like that. So yeah, it's probably a little bit of a moving target that you have to deal with.
And I think we've just decided to roll with it. And that's why we have, you know, our film team has the car, they're pulling the boat. So they can get places. We don't always need to be at wherever that interview is. We want Chris, you know, and myself to be there, to learn about it, to involve, ask questions during the interviews. But I guess it's just not always needed when the logistics are kind of a nightmare.
I was, as you were talking about, especially maybe some of the tribal voices and stuff, any injustice that still exists because people prior were unwilling to listen to whoever was speaking out against it before. And so I think that's just really cool that you're not pretending to be the first people that are bringing, you know, shedding light on this issue. How important is that to you to bear in mind, I think, the people that have maybe taken up this fight before you guys, just to carry that torch a little bit? Is that something you think about at all?
I think, yeah. I mean, we're definitely not, you know, the first people to do this. There's so many more people that are way more involved, way more knowledgeable than us, and we wouldn't even be aware of it if it wasn't for them. But I do think one of the coolest things so far has been the people we've been introduced with and the relationships we've been able to make with some people within the tribal community. And a lot of it was unplanned and kind of just natural things of by chance running into people on the beach, some tribal members that were doing a water ceremony, and then kind of hitting it off with them. And then they invited us to go fishing. They invited us to go to a fish fry on the reservation and things like that. And I think that their perspective is a super important, very interesting one, because they do have this cultural deep connection with the water. And it's, you know, we say that we do, and we do have a connection with it emotionally, but I don't think it's not as deep rooted in, it's so much part of their identity that I think it's a really key and strong portion of the documentary. And I think it's something that definitely needs to be taken into account when viewing this in a holistic perspective.
Mm-hmm. And that's both issues for the invasive and line five.
Right.
So,
yeah. Yeah. I'm just fascinated by that, because I think when we talk about those communities, as you said, it's so deeply rooted. It's almost at a level that, you know, someone like I myself probably could never reach, as much as I might appreciate those resources. It's like embedded in them. Mm-hmm. And I just think that that's really fascinating. And because their focus since the very beginning has always been on how can we maintain this for future people? And that's not something that we're all that great at, I don't think. Mm-hmm. And having that long view of maintaining this for generations of people that aren't going to be around, or that are going to be around when we're not around. Mm-hmm. You know, I myself personally, I struggle to think about things like that are going to happen once I'm gone. And so mm-hmm. it's just really cool.
And there's actually a similar, movement that's happening from the tribal perspective. They have the Mackinac O'Day group is putting on this 280-mile run that Nathan Wright is doing. And that's kind of also to bring attention to the line five and the other issues around this, that other issues around the Great Lakes. It's called the Michigan Water Odyssey. And we've been talking to them. We might meet up with them at certain times and stuff like that throughout the journey. But lots of people care, and lots of people are doing big things to try to save this. Not save, because it's not like, it's not canceled at this point, but the Great Lakes still need preservation. So
where did the beach ceremony happen?
Yeah, so that was right before that sketchy portion we talked about with the offshore winds at the Mogulpan Point area, right after we finished the crossing. Nathan Wright, who is running the Michigan Water Odyssey, is someone that we were aware of and like had been in emails back and forth and kind of like doing email tag, trying to organize something to meet up. And we landed at Mogulpan Point,
which was not our destination,
not our intended destination. The winds were just like pushing us. We're like, oh, I might as well just go there. And so we landed there, and like 15 minutes after we landed, William gets a call from Nathan. I think it was just like to check in.
No, yeah, I don't exactly remember what it was for, but we're like, oh, we're at Mogulpan's Point. And he goes, oh, Mogulpan's Point, I'm going to be there in a little bit. I've got Dusty with me, and he's going to perform a water ceremony. And I was like trying for a while to try to get some sort of ceremony, some sort of like representation from the tribal community at the Straits. And it was just like, this is a godsend. This is perfect. And coincidentally, it falls in our lap. So he was joking around. That means it's meant to be. Like, this is just two people doing hopefully some good things. And it worked out for us this time.
Dusty, the one that performed the ceremony, is what I was alluding to earlier, is just by, we didn't know who Dusty was. We just met him and got talking to him there after the water ceremony. And then 2 days later, he invited us to go out fishing with him and some friends, set out the nets at night. And then we went and picked him up in the morning and then went back to,
we were not on the boat, 'cause that's illegal.
Yeah.
We were filming from a different boat just to make sure. Right. Yeah.
And then we went back to their house and fried it up and ate it with them and got some interviews. And so just like these happenstance things that have happened, and I think are going to be the thing that I remember the most, at least, is just all the cool people we get to meet, all the cool conversations we have, more so than just the paddling itself.
Yeah. You don't have to look too far for the metaphor there of being the wind blowing you into the situation. Yeah. It's pretty great. So I don't want to jump too far ahead, but I'm curious to talk about what you anticipate once you actually land in Lansing. What do you think is going to happen?
So I think the physical landing will be a little bit anticlimactic. We're going to get there. We're going to say, wow, that was crazy. But
you're not going to have like a ribbon across. Or run,
maybe we'll see if Landon can set something up for us.
Right. Whitmer will probably be there just ready.
Shake our hands. We'll just go straight into an interview with her. But no, some of our the organizations that we've been partnered with, Oil and Water Don't Mix, the clean water action flow. We're actually throwing, not when we get there, it's going to be like a month after, just based on timings, but a rally in Lansing in support of the governor. And that was kind of a little bit spurred on by us, but they're totally taking the reins. We're not trying to take ownership of it, but it's going to be a great way to, I think, encapsulate, oh, we just came all the way from Mackinac Island to Lansing. And even though it's maybe 2 to 3 weeks in between when we got there, it's still going to be a good capstone for hopefully getting 500 plus people there at the courthouse. So should be pretty powerful.
And when is that happening?
That is, as of right now, the Saturday of the 21st or 22nd,
I think.
August.
Okay.
And I can look that up.
we got time.
Yeah. That's cool. That's really cool. So what about when, are you going to interview people when you land, or is that something that you're going to? Yeah.
We're going to be using any of the time that we have afterwards to get some of the interviews that aren't on our direct path. So that's going to be some of the representatives up in, you know, the UP, and then some representatives out of Detroit and the, like I mentioned, Sarnia representatives, and hopefully, you know, we've reached out to Dana Nessel and Gretchen Whitmer. Those aren't, you know, fully, they're in a lawsuit, so they're a little bit close-lipped precautious about the whole thing. But yes, we will be doing lots of kind of interviews post-journey when we have complete freedom to go where we want and plan perfect dates.
Cool.
As well.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
Probably lost
sleep.
Yeah, right. Good call.
Yeah, a little bit of a recovery period.
Yeah, absolutely. And no paddleboarding.
No paddleboarding.
We've been talking about how long it's going to be when we're done to when you get on a paddleboard next.
That's funny.
And you two will probably be like, all right, I'll see you in like 2 weeks. any longer.
Phone calls only.
Yeah, no Zoom or anything like that.
Yeah.
I don't want to see your face.
One thing that I was meaning to bring up, just didn't, was when we were talking about Mackinac Island being a really good starting point for all those reasons. Another really good one that we've learned through these conversations is that for a lot of the indigenous communities, Mackinac Island is like their genesis story. It's like their Garden of Eden kind of. And so that also just tying in with the pipelines being there and everything is, I think, a really symbolic way to start the trip.
So as you guys are, I don't even know that you're halfway through the trip yet in terms of mileage.
About 2/3.
Yeah. Sorry to, if that's, oh, you are 2/3.
No, sorry. 1/3.
Okay. All right. Sorry to be depressing and make you realize that, as you're counting the miles down, what are some things? I know this was obviously a cause that you were passionate about, before you set sail, but, have you noticed even within yourself over the course of this 1/3 of the trip, like that there's additional things that are coming to the surface in yourself in terms of passions and like, yes, this was worth it. Yes, this is something worth fighting for, whether that's through the good and the bad that you've experienced. Is there any of that happening?
I think that that's happening every single time I pass by something beautiful. And we see, if you ask us if you've been to some place on the West Coast, one of those awesome beach towns or something like that, we're going to be able to say yes. Like we've had passed every single beautiful place that some people cherish on the West Coast of Michigan. And so that in itself is just showing me more of the state for which I said I loved, right? That I said that was important to me. But really, before that, I was more localized in the Little Traverse Bay area. And then, you know, we've also just keep on learning about different issues, ones that we, you know, didn't exactly come in as our, you know, four main issues that we were going to start with. And that's kind of around some of the fishing practices, you know, and some differences between tribal and non-tribal fishing. And so those are things that I didn't know about and are very important to a lot of people's lives and also tie in perfectly with invasive species and, you know, fish stocks and all that kind of stuff. So we're learning more than what I expected, which is incredible.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's very similar. It's just every new section we go through, I find myself thinking like, wow, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen. And then like 20 miles later, like, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen. And so just like being so closely exposed and like we're literally on the water to all of these amazing things is, it's really, yeah, it kind of just reignites or furthers the whole reason we did it, or it kind of confirms to us that this is like why we did it. This is a good reason for why we did it. And yeah, I mean, it is, I think I always thought this, and this is just even further confirmed that the Great Lakes are like truly a national treasure, that they're like, there's nothing else like this in the world where it's just like massive inland freshwater oceans. And we're super lucky to have it. And I think it's because of that, our job to do the best we can to preserve it.
Yeah, all I keep thinking is just props to you guys. This is such a crazy endeavor and something that I know just takes a ton of time and effort and planning and all the above. And then Nick and Chris, you guys understand the kind of the content creation, the documenting aspect of it and how intensive that whole process is too. And they feed into each other. Like, what's a worthwhile documentary? Paddle 400 miles. paddling 400 miles is only worthwhile if we document it. And I know that that's a challenge, man. And so,
and some of the best things about a documentary is those surprise factors. But you have to put yourself in that position for those, you know, happy accidents to happen. And, that kind of makes that intersection of the journey and the documentary, you know, that much more special. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it at some point. Yeah.
Hopefully. Sometime in 2022. Yeah, right.
That's always the case.
Yeah. That's always a moving target.
Yeah, well, exactly. Davis talks about hitting film festivals and then, you know, after post-production, which means our production, it will close sometime in August. And so that'll probably be a while until the start of 2022. And then after that, you know, shopping it around, trying to get it on some sort of streaming platform or something like that.
Yeah.
So
we're really looking forward to
it. We'll be ready to show it wherever we can, whenever we can.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, thanks for having us on, guys. It's great to see the setup here. You guys have a cool operation.
Thank you for stopping in and taking the time. As people maybe want to follow along, I know we'll plug you guys on the social media like in the meantime, but where can they follow along with what's going on? Websites, Instagram, whatever.
Yeah, so our website is
Instagram master.
And I didn't have an Instagram before this project.
Which is, it's been great, like following along, you know, with this, your stories and the posts and everything.
Oh, great. Thank you. I enjoy putting them out there. We don't always have cell service, but if you want to follow, it's Troubled Water Film. And that goes for our website and our Instagram. You'll find it there. But Instagram is probably the best place to find it. We also have a Facebook as well. But the Instagram features, you know, daily updates via the stories and posts and stuff like that. So that's where you should follow.
Sweet.
Follow us.
Awesome.
Follow
Perfect. Us.
Right on. Well, let's get out of here and we'll head to that Mobby event. It's going to be a great time.
Yeah, perfect.
Absolutely. Should be fun.
Cool.